The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky.
Me, Jemima Kish.
And me, Charles Arthur.
And woohoo! It's like the old days!
Welcome back, Dream Team, yeah. On this week's show.
Right now, the only major improvements that can happen to Facebook, with a very few exceptions, are going to come from Facebook.
From email to APIs, open standards and tech have liberated a world of great services and innovations. Charles Arthur speaks to one of the web's greatest doers and thinkers on this topic, Nathaniel Borenstein. Also, myself and the team will be discussing the latest wearable tech in the form of Google Glass, the first of a 3-week focus on this technology trend. Charles has given his star rating, more of that later, and what's happening to 3D TV and Microsoft TV. And
for me, it's very difficult to say, oh no, we shouldn't, you know, we should ban all trolls, it's a terrible thing, we should criminalize them all.
Dr. Claire Hardacre dissects the most beguiling of online creatures, the troll. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, Jemima, Charles. It's good to be back in the hot seat at Guardian Towers.
Hi, sounding a bit husky, Alex.
I am, yes. I put that on especially for the podcast.
Is this lots of transatlantic zooming around that's done this?
Travel crud.
Generic travel crud.
It is. It's all gone up me schnoz.
It's all that time spent seeking asylum in The Guardian.
Yeah, or seeking asylum somewhere that has sun. Anyway, this week we have sun, and Microsoft shuts down MSN TV, the service that they purchased in 1997 for $425 million. Charles, what's the story here?
So Web TV, or MSN TV as it was also known, was basically a set-top box device which Microsoft would pump internet TV through to you. So it was very much a forerunner to what we see now with Apple TV, Google TV, except it was Microsoft and it was doing it sort of, you know, 10 years before other people were.
Were they simply doing it too early? Why has it faded away?
It's the problem that you have for all internet-connected TV things. And certainly to some extent, yeah, it was doing it too early. It was all the promise of internet TV, all the sort of the great gold rush ideas that there were around the dot-com boom, which was, yeah, everything's going to be on the internet, which overlook the fact that you've got to get past all the content providers, all the gatekeepers. In the case of TV, you've got both. You've got both the content providers who say, no, I don't want to put it on the internet. Even an internet delivering device such as, you know, the IP-based web TV. And also there's the gatekeepers, which are the people like Comcast in the US and the other companies which provide the cable TV services, who will often get a bit sticky about if, you know, a content provider is going to be supplying Microsoft with content, then they're going to be a bit difficult with the content provider about how often they get onto their cable network. So there's all sorts of endemic problems there for people in the US, which is one of the reasons why internet TV has been really quite slow to take off there. I mean, it's a very different picture in the UK.
Jemima.
I think initially this made them quite a lot of money and it was a good status buy for them because the guy that founded it, Steve Perlman, was quite sort of ahead of his time and very well respected. But since then, I think in the early 2000s, there was a bit of a decline in numbers and then they started getting lots more competition from AOL and people. And since then, what they want to do now, obviously, is make Xbox their hub for all things entertainment. So it's just not a relevant product for them anymore. And when you look through the FAQ of Dear MSN TV subscriber, it has lots of information on how to kind of neatly tie up all your services that, you know, you might be accessing through the service. It's just a long list of things I've never heard of and never used, bar Hotmail.
Does it say buy an Xbox?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Not
because
quite.
There's a strong relationship here with the Xbox, isn't there, with Xbox One. It's effectively the Xbox has superseded itself. It's like, oh, Starbucks cannibalism, for example.
Yeah, well, I don't know even if they had ploughed a huge amount of investment and done the best that they could with MSN TV. It's essentially a web browser for TV.
It just makes much more sense to have the Xbox because the Xbox can do games as well. And, you know, there's a certain audience which wants to play games. And if you can offer TV as well, offer DVD playing, then you know you're on the way. And given that the Xbox has to be internet connected anyway, why would you not have a Microsoft device, which lots of people have, and you're pretty certain they do, and just stream it out all through that? There's no point in having a separate set-top box.
But this doesn't mean that web TV is dead, or you know, web TV TM may be dead, MSN TV may be dead, but of course the web space TV services, it's quite a thriving landscape at the minute, isn't it?
Well, there's huge competition in this space, and multiple providers, whether you do it through a set-top box or whether you watch a service on your computer, which is what I prefer to do. And then one of my favourite soapbox subjects is about smart TV and how it's really not that smart at all, because the experience is so poor. And that's where the real potential is, because they're beautiful screens, they're very high quality, and when they're internet enabled, they should offer amazing services, but the experience just isn't there at the moment. But
the trouble is, trying to do an EPG for the internet is nigh on impossible. What content do you filter by? How do you find a way to get around? I mean, you know, as it is, we use search engines to organise our thinking about where shall I go next. But the problem is with television is you could say, oh, well, I'd really like to watch that old, you know, Rockford Files or Star Trek or, you know,
Rockford
where
Files.
Where do you start? It's
got to be
so
voice
impossible.
Input. I think that's the future for smart TVs, because the input through a remote control or a keyboard isn't satisfying enough. But that's probably another discussion.
It is. Siri, take me to the next story. Also in dangerously close to MediaPod territory, the BBC has put the brakes on its 3D TV offering due to, and I quote, lack of public appetite. Ouch. Wasn't this the future, Jemima?
Have you ever watched anything on a 3D TV?
I have watched a 3D TV, but I have not watched anything 3D on a 3D TV.
No, I've only watched like trial prototype stuff. I've never been motivated enough to go out and buy a TV. And that's what the statistics say. It says here that 1.5 million homes have enabled sets, but only half of those even watch it. Even something like the Olympics last year, only half of the people that actually have a 3D TV are using it. So, you know, perhaps the experience sounds more exciting or compelling than it is.
Charles, you wrote this article, so tell us a little bit more about, you know, what you know. Give us a bit of the meat on the bone.
Well, the BBC had a 3D project which was going since 2010. They did things like broadcasting the Wimbledon finals in 3D. They broadcast the Olympics opening ceremony. They broadcast various bits of content, sort of, you know, non-special content, so Mr. Stink, which is the David Walliams story, and also the Queen's Christmas broadcast, which obviously needs to be 3D. And they just couldn't see the uptake. And it's interesting.
5%, I think, 5%, of potential viewers.
Yeah, potential 5%. Viewers did it. And that's only people who've got the 5% of the 3D enabled. So it's a pretty small number. And I asked people on Twitter about it, and they said, you know, the thing is, the angles aren't as good. When you're watching it on Wimbledon with it, the camera angles are different, and you don't actually get the benefit. It's higher up, or it's lower down, I think, and so it cuts off the baseline. You can't actually see if the ball is close or whatever.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because certainly this was something that people were talking about when 3D movies first came out in the 50s. Mm. You know, the only person who was apparently very good at making 3D movies made a film called House on Haunted Hill. This is where my cinema gimmicks geekery comes in. And his name was Andre de Toth, and he only had one eye. So interestingly, he couldn't see the effects that he was creating with the two cameras, with the 3D process. So are we now at that point with television, where people are now going, ooh, whiz-bangy, here's a gimmick, as opposed to thinking about the affordances of what you could do with the television set?
It's interesting that 3D in films has been more successful, and perhaps making the most of this beautiful kind of spectacle works better when it's a real event thing around a film. James Cameron said recently that the filmmaking industry actually hasn't been making the most of that. They've just been retrospectively applying a kind of 3D image on films that had enough special effects anyway, actually, and being, you know, Mr. Avatar, who's very keen to do this in the most meaningful possible way.
Although I have to say, I went to see, I took the insistence of my son, I went to see The Phantom Menace in 3D. And you think, wow, the pod race is going to be awesome in 3D. Nope. Totally 2D. And any 3D-ness, it's sort of post-effect added because it wasn't made in 3D, is a complete disappointment. The only time I've actually seen a 3D effect in a film and gone, oh, that's good, was in Up. Again, you know, children made me see it. But though it's a good film. But there's a particular scene when they're swinging around some rocks and you go, oh, yeah, that's really good.
Charles, what effect is this going to have on BBC? Because as far as I understand, this is the entire 3D section that has been axed.
They're not going to make any more broadcasts for 3D for the foreseeable future. So the Doctor Who special in November is going to be the last 3D thing you'll see for them for a while. They haven't decided when, if ever, they're going to make more 3D. It might be a question of waiting for uptake. Though I suspect that actually smart TV, second screens through things like Twitter is actually a far more important, far better way of getting people to engage with content. You know, if you want people to engage with what you're putting out on the screen, then these days you put a hashtag on it.
I also heard a delicious thing somebody was saying, somebody at MTV was saying that there is a time code or something that allows you, even if you're watching at a later date, at a later time, that signals something on your companion screen that will bring up content that's very specific to that particular thing, which is interesting as well because that then takes the live viewing aspect away from it as well. Because historically, if you wanted to push stuff to people along with the television program or other kind of media, you would have to be there live. But anyway,
yeah, there are startups really exploring that whole second screen for catch-up thing, which is a really interesting challenge, I think.
It absolutely is. Now, just briefly, in this story, Charles, do you know what the marketplace is like in the US for 3D TV? Because certainly it seems as if there's a heck of a lot more 3D TV sets that have been sold in the US.
Yeah, you would think it'd be great, but ESPN, which is the sports channel out there, is just killing off its 3D channel because it says there's been not enough uptake by home users. So it seems to have failed on both sides of the Atlantic so far. I just think, you know, second screen is a far more interesting, far more interactive. It's far more how we use TV. 3D really demands a lot of concentration and also demands, if you've got to wear the glasses, that you look a bit dorky.
Talking of dorky glasses.
Speaking of dorky glasses, wonderfully, wonderfully segued. Also, you know, it's about the immersive experience as 3D, and so is the experience of wearing wearable technologies. This is the first of our three-week analysis of the latest tech trend, wearable technology. Charles, you had the hands-on guide to Google Glass. Jemima, I know you've also been glassed.
I have fiddled.
Charles, what is it like?
It's not as immersive as you might expect. What happens is you put the glasses on. I was wearing them without lenses because you don't have to have lenses on. And you get once you turn them on, which you do by lifting your head up in a
like
sort
a
of way,
nervous twitch.
As though you're having a slight seizure, which turns on a screen, a little screen above your right eye. And it appears to be floating about 6 to 8 inches in front of you. And you get the time and the words in quotes, OK Glass. And if you say OK Glass, then it brings up a menu of things you can do. Google something, take a photo, take a video, start a Google Hangout.
Start a Hangout, yeah.
And you can do those things, but it's not as thrilling as you might hope for, really. You're sort of hoping for it to enhance the world around you, that suddenly everything will be filled with light and that, you know, you look at an object and say, it's a Sennheiser microphone, which is actually made in Germany by small, very experienced little people who used to be Oompa-Loompas. In fact, it doesn't work like that. It's just a little menu and you can say, how high is the impulse?
But that, I mean, isn't that ultimately the future of technology? You know, we always have these incredibly high hopes.
That it disappoints us?
Yeah, we have these incredibly high hopes.
But
you know, somebody has to make a first step.
Exactly. It is a first step. It's just about ambitious enough to illustrate the basic technology. And they've left all of the exciting creative stuff to the developers that will make the apps to go on it. They've also had to make the concession that they're not going to include facial recognition or recognition technology so far, which basically cuts out a huge chunk of the usefulness, but it will come later on.
Well, certainly it would come later on if there wasn't upset in countries that are far more privacy-centred.
This is the really interesting thing, is that far more than the technology, Google's job is to set the public expectation or to counter a lot of those concerns and establish the standard for what is acceptable and to get people used to the idea. I think the really interesting stuff in this space with this particular technology and the kind of implications that it has is not going to happen for a very long time. And I was quite frustrated when wearing it because it's quite invasive, on the wearer, actually. Just physically, it's quite an invasive thing to wear a pair of glasses when you're not used to wearing glasses. I'd rather have a chip under my skin. I would actually rather have, a tiny chip just behind my eyebrow, which would do the same thing, and I'm just sort of impatient for this early baby steps, being really cautious.
Don't mess around. Implant me now.
Can you tell me what the experience was like for you? I mean, where were you wearing it?
They took me into Google. They took me into Google. I went into Google, handcuffed.
You went in the spaceship.
Willingly.
I went into Google. They kind of sat me down and sort of talked at me and said...
Then they put the probes in.
Yeah, they put the bloody chip in. No, they wouldn't put the chip in. And they sat me down. They let me wear the glass and then they took me through each of the instructions, which was video, hangout, map. Maps, actually, as the only thing that was slightly more towards an application, was the most insightful thing because it obviously knows where you are. It has a Wi-Fi connection. So the map that you see, which is a very, very simplified, it's nowhere near as kind of rich as what you'd see on a smartphone, but a very simplified map. It shows where you are. And as you move your head around from north to south, the map moves. And that's kind of cool. But I just want to press fast forward and go forward, say, 2 years until it's exciting and
Charles, tell me, what are their plans for this? Are they leaving this open to developers? Are they going to make it open source to allow other people to throw ideas into our brains using this using this crazy technology?
Or? So it's interesting, actually, that the Google terms of use are really very tight, and Google will control the flow of information from Glass to the outside world. It's actually quite hard to get stuff directly off it. And they will retain a kill switch so that you can't just go
for
off
the
and
person
use
wearing it.
They can turn it off remotely. They can identify it. So if they sort of felt you were doing things they don't want you to be doing with it, then actually they do have the power. And it's in the license, it's in the terms of service. And
do those scroll up as you're when you're using
Glass? Yeah, you sort of nudge your head backwards and forwards to scroll the menu,
which is
a really silly, sort of overly basic gesture, I can't believe. Well, you can actually swipe the side of them as well. Yeah. But
I mean, there's privacy concerns have been expressed in the US by a US senator and also in Europe by privacy watchdogs. So I think Google is aware of the fact that it could all go horribly wrong in PR terms for it. So they are retaining this tight lead on it. But yeah, I mean, like Jemima says, there's a lot yet to be worked out in terms of the interface. It's very hard. Even after you, I mean, I was using it for some time, and it's very hard to build the mental model, the mental map of where you are in the use of the phone. So when you have a smartphone, you hit the home key, and you have a set of icons, or you have a sort of a window of tiles in front of you. And you go, okay, I know where I am, and these are the places I can go to. With Glass, it's really hard. You sort of do things by tapping and wiping your finger along and wiping your finger up and down the side rim, and that can take you into menus and into sharing and into deleting, and it's very hard actually to build the mental map of where are you. It doesn't come up easily because there's no point at which the menu in front of you says, here you are, here's where you are in the sort of decision tree of the system.
Is that not, though, part of the linguistic experience of learning any kind of new technology, just sort of figuring out? You remember the old days, in fact, on some websites you can still see a site map, which, sends you through the hierarchies of the subfolders and submenues.
This is something I think we're going to have to get really attuned to, because I've said before that if you think logically about the development of mobile phones and voice recognition, you could have a phone with no screen at all. So we are going to have to get better at visualizing that kind of audio navigation.
But that's the difficulty, is that you don't get any cues when you're in a particular place. I was looking at some videos, and you have a swipe up to go back or swipe forward or something, and I deleted it instead of sharing it or not sharing it. I was trying to cancel the thing I'd done, but there was no gesture and no obvious hint of what to do.
You have to shake your head.
Well, possibly, yeah.
Maybe it just shouldn't be that there's any kind of directional map at all. It should just all be instructions.
What other sort of Google Glass style technologies are already out there, or at least that we know are in development?
Well, I bought my son a pair of spy glasses, which cost £23.85 and will take photos and video.
Oh.
From Amazon.
When I was in Stockholm, I found Momoto, which is about an inch square. It's a lapel camera, and it takes a picture every, I think, 2 minutes all day, which sounds a bit freaky, but then when you get back and they're uploaded, you have a record of your day and you can pick out the most relevant bits. So it basically saves you having to take a picture.
There's a company called Recon, which makes ski goggles and also now triathlete goggles, I think. Sort of glasses, a bit like Google Glass, which will give you data like how fast are you going, how far have you gone, where the hell are you?
Waterproof?
I'm not sure if they're waterproof.
Triathlete? You'd have to be
possibly.
Waterproof. Anyway.
Yeah, perhaps they're for the cyclist, but the
triathlete. Well, it sounds to me, though, that what you guys are focusing on more than anything else in terms of competitors is, as you say, Jemima, the kind of the recording technologies, the photographs. And Charles, you mentioned the data. Mm. So it's kind of, it's more of a kind of, it seems to me that it's a hands-free, you know, Super GoPro that also feeds back into your, you know, into your perception,
and
what you need to know right
that's
now.
That's also the easy bit. And the bit that is going to be difficult for all of these companies to navigate, and the bit that Google has to lead on, is public expectation and acceptance.
Well, expectation, it sounds as if both of you are slightly disappointed with the
offering. Yeah, but we're not normal, are we?
I don't know. You look kind of normal to me.
Oh, well, that's nice.
I don't know. Let me take a picture. Okay, glass.
I don't look normal when I'm wearing a pair of Google glasses. That's for sure.
Well, next week, we will be pondering those social implications of wearable technology. So let us know your thoughts. And if you have an idea of what big tech trend absolutely needs an in-depth 3-week look by the team that knows all, let us know at Guardian TW. For all those stories and to watch Charles Arthur give Google Glass a run for its money, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. The internet, it's a festering cesspool of hate, right? All you need to do to see this is to log on to a comment board and feel yourself awash with the bile spewed by anonymous haters. But before you tarnish all online idiots with the same brush, it turns out they're a nuanced bunch. Festering my own sense of hateful curiosity, I spoke with Dr. Claire Hardacre, who spent the last 6 years hanging out with warped minds. But first, I asked her, what exactly is a troll?
There's actually no one definite theory about where this word comes from, and there's no one accepted theory. There are at least two potential sources for it. There's the troll, the mythical monster under the bridge type, which I think we've all heard of, you know, with the billy goat Scruff trying to cross the bridge and the troll comes out and says, you know, I will eat you. And then the goats, basically each one says, wait for my brother, he's a bit bigger, and so on. And the biggest one comes along and butts the goat into the river. So that's one historical sort of from the Norway, Norwegian type of history of the word. The other history of the word trolling apparently ties into a type of fishing, which is where you drag a net along the bottom of the sea. You basically scoop up everything and you sort of, that's a method of fishing. And so trolling has relationships, it seems, to both, because you do get phrases like don't bite, don't feed the troll. So biting in the sense of fishing, you know, when fish bite on hooks. Don't feed the troll in the sense of don't feed it goats type thing, that kind of thing. So there's no accepted theory, but there are a few different potential etymological backgrounds for that term.
And how did it come into first use in reference to the internet and bad behavior?
It seems to date from around about the late 80s. The earliest instance I found, I think, was something like 1987. I dug out the earliest I could find for my thesis and sort of put it in there as a first example. It may even predate that, because where I found it was on Usenet, which has been around since sort of early 80s. And earlier messages in Usenet weren't necessarily stored. They only started to be stored from a certain point. So it's possible that it's actually been around since potentially even the very late 70s. And it was typically used back then to relate to people who kept going off discussion, going off on tangents, and sort of not really following on with the topic.
It wasn't the kind of the hate that we associate
trolling
with.
Exactly. So the way that the word has been used historically, back in sort of the late 80s that we have records of, versus how it's used now, seem to be quite different. Now it seems to be a blanket term for all kinds of horrible online behaviours. Back then it seemed to be quite a specific type of behaviour.
Let's jump forward to those horrible online behaviours, because mm-hmm. those certainly are the ones that are under debate both socially, politically, and, you know, around coffee tables and in the backs of taxi cabs. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what your research seems to have found, is that there's lots and lots of different varieties, or as you wrote in the Comment is Free piece in The Guardian, a wide variety of flavours to trolling. Can you tell me about a few of them?
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that I found in the data, kind of as you point out, is there are a lot more, to use an unpleasant phrase, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's more than one way to aggravate someone online. The probably the classic one that we've now all heard of, which didn't seem to exist before a certain period, probably about 10 years ago, I don't think you would find this, is what's known as RIP or memorial trolling, which is the type. One really unpleasant instance was when Gary Speed committed suicide, a number of memorial boards came up on Facebook, and within minutes of those memorial boards being posted, people were going on posting very unpleasant jokes in sort of quote marks and puns and that kind of thing, deliberately sort of finding humour, if you like, in his death. There are other types of trolling as well, sort of something that's known as concern trolling, which is, it can be political, that's where you tend to find it. You join a political group or message board, you purport to be on that side, whichever it is, but then you sow seeds of doubt from within. You say, well, I like this policy, but I'm very unsure about the leadership, I worry about this, I worry about that. You try and come across as though you are a genuine, meaningful part of the group, but you try and sow dissent and doubt from within and to start turning people against that group or that party.
Now, these are phenomena that we see offline as well. I mean, mm-hmm. there's the terrible examples of people picketing at funerals in the U.S. We see this a lot, and also we've seen covert operations from within political organizations. To what degree are the people who perpetrate these types of online hate, or I suppose that's quite it's a difficult word to use in this context, mm-hmm. but this online kind of action, different from those people who would perpetrate it offline?
One of the differences I think that strikes me is that the online version, whilst it can sometimes have political motivations, and you only have to look at the Occupy movements and their relationships with groups like Anonymous, quite a lot of the time, it seems to be that the main kinds of trolling are driven by entertainment. It's done for fun, it's done for amusement. Some of the kinds of trolling, if you want to call them that we see offline, the picketing of the funerals, seem to be motivated, at least in terms of the funerals, by other sort of apparently motivated by religious beliefs and so forth. They're not necessarily done for that same kind of fun factor, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does, because I've spoken with a few trolls in my time, both being, you know, being the victim of trolling behavior, but also seeking to understand the psychology and the motivations of trolls. And it definitely seems to me that there's an element of political. You know, many trolls have ideologies or ideological stances that they're trying to recognize or to motivate. But then also they are doing it, as they say, for the lulz. They're basically trying to create mischief. So is this
exactly
something that's familiar with the or resonant with the work that you've done?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that is a very difficult position to take up is people sometimes say, you know, so should we criminalize all trolls? Should we deal with every single type of troll as a criminal, as a, you know, some kind of unpleasant individual? And one of the difficult answers that I sometimes have to give is I don't think that would be a smart thing to do, because in some cases, you do have trolls who essentially they're using the trolling behavior as a tool. They're trying to achieve an end, and perhaps other ends that they've tried, you know, using the political process or going through the accepted routes hasn't seemed to achieve any success for them. And so whilst this isn't a particularly laudable way of doing it, it does seem to be more effective. And so they've fallen back on this. It's effectively a bit like the dissenting voice against the government. If you have the quiet dissenting voice that fits in and it's easy to block out, then that's not going to achieve any ends. What you sometimes need, and I'm not suggesting trolling is the right way to do this, but what you do sometimes need is the voice that breaks through the quiet barrier and gets heard and maybe achieves the ends. And sometimes the way that that's done is by, you know, disrupting the ongoing norms of how things are done. So for me, it's very difficult to say, oh, no, we shouldn't, you know, we should ban all trolls. It's a terrible thing. We should criminalize them all. I don't think it's necessarily always the right way to go about things, but you have to wonder why someone has chosen that as a way to express their political beliefs. Is it because they feel that in other ways they just don't get heard?
It's interesting, though, that you say that in this article, in the comment piece, you also say that people don't take the effects of trolling particularly seriously. So on the one hand, we have people saying, you know, ban this sick filth, for want of a better expression, or at least legislate against it. And then on the other side, we have people who are perfectly, you know, happy to say, well, this is just online. It's just the internet.
Well, that's one of the things where for me, that is the big question. And to be honest, I guess if I'm brutally honest, I don't have the perfect answer. That's kind of in the Guardian piece. I was almost trying to say, this is the big question. How do we deal with this? Because you can basically say, well, yes, they are just letting off steam. You should have the right at some point, even if it's an iconoclastic or an offensive or an extreme view, you should have the right to at least be able to express yourself. But at the same time, you also have, for me, you have an obligation for responsibility as well, that if what you are saying is going to hurt someone or be damaging, you know, should you be held accountable for that? So my big question is, when you get into that behavior, which is very difficult to say categorically that's trolling, but at the same time you're harming someone or potentially harming someone, how, you know, is that trolling? How do you deal with that? Is legislation the right way forward? If it's not legislation, you know, what do we need to be doing with that kind of thing?
And at the same time, what is the lowest hanging fruit of trolling behavior is not necessarily the most effective trolling behavior, or even the type of trolling behavior that that is most common.
Exactly. Because, I mean, essentially, for the research that I see, and it's a really classic example, in the data that I have, I essentially have these sort of six or seven major strategies that occur. The most obvious on record, you know, incontrovertible examples where people go on and say, you're all horrible, I wish you'd all die, they practically get no responses because it's so obvious that they're there to cause arguments. People just block them and there's no debate, there's no discussion, there's no, oh God, that's terrible. They just get blocked. The ones who are by far and away infinitely more effective and more damaging and stick around longer and disrupt the group further are the ones who are subtle, who keep it off record, who they're never quite openly doing something that you could say, that's not right, you should stop doing that. But yet they disrupt the group, they continue even after being asked, why don't you try and do this in a different way? Those are the ones that are actually really damaging.
You argue that we need to see a change in attitude.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that change in attitude is? Because at the moment, we've presented two different attitudes. We've represented the ban the sick filth and also the, well, it's just the internet arguments. Mm-hmm. What is the attitude that we need to change with regards to trolling?
I think the one that we need to really think about changing is this idea that when it's on the internet, it's not real. It's just the internet and you can just switch it off. And if you don't like it, you should just log off. That's the one thing that we really have to get to grips with, because that, for me, that's a really frustrating victim blaming type of mentality. It's a bit like I put in the article, you know, no one would tell a woman not to leave the house at night because she might get raped. And so for me, it doesn't make sense to tell someone, if you don't like being trolled, leave the internet, you know, get off the internet, don't use it. We have to, I mean, I think most of us now, the internet is a fundamental part of our lives. Our phones go with us everywhere. This can follow us to inside our houses. You know, there is, in some respects, there is no way to get offline and stay a part of modern society. So for me, that attitude of it's just the internet has got to change. We've got to take it seriously. When people say someone is doing this thing online, it's making me miserable, I want to be able to stop it, we need to take that seriously and say, okay, if you're not happy with the way this person is behaving, we need to give you the mechanism to be able to protect yourself from it. So we don't necessarily always think, right, that person has done something wrong, but we need to be able to give the person who feels like a victim a way of defending themselves or protecting themselves.
Dr. Claire Hardacre from Lancaster University. For more of her research findings, head to the Happy Meadows of The Guardian's Comment is Free. Next up, Charles, you met with computer scientist and inventor of the MIME protocol for formatting multimedia, essentially the backbone of the email attachment, Nathaniel Borenstein. Nathaniel is concerned about the future of the internet, is he not?
So, yes, the thing that Borenstein, who's been around really since the internet started getting going, he was key in thinking about some of the open protocols that he used for things like email. And, of course, you know, as we know, the web is built around open protocols. TCP/IP is an open protocol, so anyone can use it. The specifications available to anyone, you can understand it and implement systems using it. And his concern is about the way that so many organizations, so many corporations are abandoning open protocols and going instead to proprietary ones. So, for example, Apple has never released the codes for how FaceTime, which is its video calling system, works. Microsoft owns Skype. Skype's never released those for video calling on Skype. And Google hasn't said how Hangouts works. And if you look around, what you find is that more and more the open protocols that used to rule the web and that allowed us to tie so many things together from sort of 95 through to 2005 have been closed. So I asked him how worried he is about the future of the internet.
I think some companies, it's in their DNA to pursue a world domination. You know, that's sort of the attitude they have from the beginning, so that they take that attitude even when they're much smaller and might conceivably be better off with open standards. And there's a few companies that have the opposite DNA. Google is an interesting example. They still, by and large, support open standards, even though for some things they might be better off trying to monopolize. And I think that comes down to the ideology of the founders. But there's probably as many answers as there are major players here. IBM's a very interesting example. IBM, back in the 1960s, played the game of dominance very well. They controlled operating systems. They practically controlled software. There was a small software market and things IBM didn't care about. But then they had their hard times in the 80s and 90s, I guess mostly the 90s. And when they emerged from that, they found themselves behind in some key areas like operating systems, you know, OS2 losing out to Windows. And they seized on open source as a way to try to wrest some of that market share back. So by using open source, they get the benefit of other people working on the software. By using open standards, they get the benefit of perhaps a larger community than just the community of people using the IBM software. And the hope there is that IBM plus several other players can compete with the dominant player in some particular market.
Now, so open source was a sort of accelerator for them. It's sort of like a catapult which took them into markets that they couldn't have got to if they'd just been writing the software themselves and trying to iterate in that way.
Yeah. Yeah,
but for Google, I mean, Google seems to be exhibiting this sort of split personality in some ways. So recently we've seen it say that it's going to stop providing Exchange Active Server interfaces for new devices such as smartphones. And it said it was going to focus on the CardDAV for sort of address books and CalDAV for calendars. And then it said more recently that it's going to stop supporting CalDAV in favor of its own Google Calendar API. So is it sort of one of those things where it likes open source as long as it gives it benefit, but it doesn't like it so much when it might allow competitors to encroach?
Well, I don't know enough about the inside of Google to say exactly what they're thinking. I do know that they have a commendable discipline of letting 1,000 flowers bloom, but then pruning most of them on the theory that they can only have so many successful products. And so the things you just mentioned that they're discontinuing, like CalDAV, if they're discontinuing that, I doubt that it was so much an ideological thing of being opposed to the open standard as it was a belief that they had something that was fundamentally better. And in the case of calendaring software, it's fairly easy to believe because calendaring software is not the best example of open source, open standards, and therefore open source software. Calendaring software was developed towards the end of the real open standards era of the internet, and as a result, it sort of froze in time a little too soon.
That sort of end of the 90s sort of time.
Yeah, yeah.
So is then there, is that part of the problem, that that open standards tend to be a bit squidgy and they're, you know, it's a bit hard to really get a handle on, whereas if you're building your own API, say in the way of Twitter or whatever, you know exactly what it's going to do. You're completely clear what the standard is there because you set it down. And it's much easier to get a group of people within the company around the table and agree a standard than it is to get people from five companies or the whole of the internet together and agree something there.
Absolutely. And that is, in fact, historically why even the companies that were doing pioneering things that they wanted to be based on open standards would typically build a first version, set it loose on the internet, and then start working with interested parties on standardizing it. That was a pretty successful paradigm for quite a while. But it's definitely faster, yeah, to design it yourself than to design it with a committee. And the most successful designs have started with a smaller design by one company or by a small group of people, which was then taken to a standards body like the IETF and refined there. Things that are being done from scratch don't tend to fare as well in a standards committee.
So Nat, is it basically that you've got a bit of internet ennui, which I have to say I've, you know, during my years of journalism, I have seen from time to time. I think the first time I saw it was in 1995 with Clifford Stoll, who sort of famously caught a hacker because he saw a very slight difference between the costs attributed to a mainframe. It was like sort of a 0.35 of a cent or something. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this fantastic book called The Cuckoo's Egg. But by 1995, he decided the internet has played out. It's just, you know, it's boring, actually. And all the people on it, they're really wasting their time. From time to time down the years, I've sort of seen people who seem to be suffering from internet ennui. They sort of say, yeah, well, it's all played out. You know, it's all sort of done. It's stagnant. Nothing's changing. And I'm wondering if you're sort of succumbing a bit to that disease at all.
Actually, I think it's just the opposite. I think that I'm frustrated with the fact that the internet isn't improving as fast as it could. I certainly don't believe the internet is all played out. I think that the proprietary protocols and applications that have taken a dominant place in some parts of the internet have discouraged certain kinds of innovation. So it frustrates me. But I certainly wouldn't say that I'm suffering from ennui. I'm perhaps more suffering from anger or frustration.
What are the things that you feel are being held back from, you know, what are the innovations you feel aren't happening then?
Well, it's very hard to say what innovations are missing, because by definition, an innovation is when somebody has a brilliant idea. What's missing is the ground on which innovation happens. So if, for example, instead of Facebook being a closed garden as it is, it interoperated well with Google Plus and whatever else, there would be more alternatives in that case, then the set of people who are in a position to improve on it would be much larger. Right now, the only major improvements that can happen to Facebook, with a very few exceptions, are going to come from Facebook.
Charles Arthur with Nathaniel Bornstein. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for breaking tech news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Also on the site this week, you can watch our latest tech session video.
Experience Web is about going onto a website and then interacting with products, interacting with information, and having a great experience.
Jemima meets Graham Cook, founder of the data analytics company Qubit. Don't miss it. And next week on the pod, we are continuing our look at wearable technology. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps, but from me, Alex Kwiatkowski, Jemima Kish, and Charles Arthur, we will be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.